The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Catherine Shaw, and before we hear the show, we just wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more information on building your own beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. Now on with the show.
Hang on to your portfolios. It's The Guardian Film Show, a rock of cinematic probity since 2012. Whatever the economic storms in the world at large, our crack team of analysts and advisors will ensure that your movie investment remains as safe as houses.
Let's see what you got.
You smell that? What is that?
What?
What's that smell?
A cologne?
No.
Opportunity?
No. Money.
Oh, okay.
I smell money.
Okay.
Coming up on this week's show, director Hu Hsiao-hsien whisks us back to the splendour of the Tang dynasty with the assassin.
You know, countries were saying that, well, the mothers took the drug, it's their fault the children are like this. But Harold Evans came along and he said, no, this is the fault of the pharmaceutical companies and they're the ones who must pay.
Newspaper editor Harold Evans uncovers corporate scandal in attacking the devil.
Utterly and totally miserably inadequate.
And Sandra Bullock wants your vote in the political satire, Our Brand is Crisis.
There's only one wrong in this. Only one, and that is losing.
Maybe check and see if anyone understood that.
Levate la mano si hablo inglés. Gracias.
First up, it's Oscar contender The Big Short, a splenetic crash course in CDOs, credit default, and the subprime bubble. Catherine Shaw called a board meeting with director Adam McKay and star Steve Carell.
You know what? I'm pissed off.
American people
are getting screwed by the big banks.
And I am getting madder and madder.
It's unbelievable.
Then this guy walks into my office and says,
there's some shady stuff going down.
Apathy can breed some formidably bad things in society. And if fraud and fraudulent behavior goes unchecked and unnoticed, it just gets worse and worse.
Michael, how are you?
I found something really interesting.
The whole housing market is propped up on these bad loans. They will fail.
The housing market is rock solid.
It's a time bomb.
I practiced for this movie explaining it. I got to the point where I could tell my 10-year-old daughter what happened in a minute. And yet none of the news media ever really tried to explain this. There's a great podcast that was out for This American Life that did a really great job of explaining it. There are a few cases where people did a good job, but the mainstream media didn't really make much of an attempt. And whenever that happens, you're going to have scapegoating. I mean, look what happened in Greece. All of a sudden, there's a neo-Nazi party rising up from economic frustration. Well, what that means is those people don't really understand what happened. They're angry. They want to put their anger somewhere. Same thing happened in the U.S. with the Tea Party rose up. And these were people that were frustrated by what happened but didn't have all the information. Information's powerful. It's the bottom line. Without it, really bad things can happen.
No one is paying attention because the banks are too busy getting paid obscene fees to sell these bonds. A's, zero. B's, zero. Double B's, zero. Triple B's, zero. And then that happens.
What is that?
That's America's housing market.
Joined by Peter Bradshaw and Henry Barnes. Peter, this is a heist movie of sorts, isn't it?
Kind of. I certainly wanted it to be a heist movie. And part of the problem is that this movie kind of thinks that it may be going to be a heist movie or something as enjoyable as that, but it turns out to be something far more high-minded. I've got to say, this is the most smug and overrated film of this year's awards season. It can't decide whether it wants to be sexy like Gordon Gekko or sort of PC, anti-banker kind of solemnity and piety. Mm. And I just found it almost outrageous that it was so stranded between the two of these things.
If it's, it's an amoral story, so yeah, do it. In
I wanted
a
it to be
amoral
exactly.
Way.
I wanted to bring Adam. I wanted Adam McKay to bring to it some of the cheerful cynicism and irony he brought to his less pretentious comedies, like Anchorman or even the dreaded The Other Guys or something like that. But no, he has to be join in with this mood of cleverer than thou, because they're certainly cleverer than you and me, and also holier than thou. Mm. because they disapprove mightily of this awful business that preceded the 2008 crash, while failing really to do anything about it other than make money out of it. So it's another movie about the big swinging dicks and the masters of the universe, only they're the sort of politically correct version. I wanted it either to be suffused with gleeful energy, like Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street, which just goes with it and it's exciting, or arguably,
or a Jacques Hughes,
something like 99 Homes, which had genuine, clear moral outrage, or alternatively, something like Charles Ferguson's documentary Inside Job, which lays out what's happening without any kind of we're so clever sort of dinner party mannerisms, which I find so exasperating about this movie. This movie just does none of that.
There was a point where I thought, oh, we're supposed to kind of sympathise with these people. And that's a big hurdle I can never quite get over.
I disagree totally with Peter. I've invested in this film. And I invested in it, watched it twice, loved it. I think what it's doing is basically saying that capitalism is the house and you can't beat the house, right? And whoever you are, however hard you try, however much heart you have about the game you're playing, money and greed are going to win out, even if you're banking on the economy and banking on the happiness of millions and millions of people. What this film does greatly is that it transposes Michael Lewis's love of numbers and how numbers affect who we are as a society and us as individuals into a film. And also, Adam McKay has a big, strong background in podcasts now. He's working with Gimlet Media to make podcasts about the financial system and about how that affects society. And I think what he's done here is taken the podcast medium, i.e. snappy little stories that are immediately grabby about individuals, and then put that into film. And it does feel weird. The tone of this film shifts all over the place. The little jumps to Selena Gomez and Anthony Bourdain do sound really odd and distracting. But to me, it was just compelling. It's not something that's saying, these are the wrongs and they should have been corrected much earlier and we should try harder to not let this happen again. I don't think it's saying that. I think it's saying, this is the system we have built for ourselves. This is a country that is now addicted to this system. We are all living part of it. There are people that see the flaws in it and then they exploit that system for themselves and make money. But that's all they've ever been taught to do and all we're ever taught to do.
I don't think the film is saying everybody is guilty. I think the film is saying that, well, the system was broke, sure, it's certainly saying that, and it's also saying that the system is riddled with a kind of moral rottenness, but it's also trying to get away with reconfiguring some of its other players as hero rebellious outsiders, when in fact they're just insiders, they're just more bankers. They're just people just people at the race course who've spotted that the horse everybody thinks is going to lose is in fact going to win, and they've found a bookmaker to take their £1,000 bet. I'm afraid I totally see what Hen's saying, and I find his point of view very valid, but I have to say that there is an element of disingenuousness in this film, which I can't get past.
You hate Wall Street, but maybe it's time to quit.
I love my job.
You hate your job.
I love my job.
You're miserable.
I love my job. I love my job, honey.
Mark.
Cynthia, I'm okay. I really am. Hey. No, my cab. That's my cab. That is my cab.
It's not schmuck.
I'll call you later.
The Big Short explaining the crimes of the past to ensure that it never happens again. Moving swiftly on, we come to The Assassin, which is safely anchored in the ancient misty forest, where all one has to fear is a sword at your throat or a magical smoky demon spell. Xu Qi is the assassin, born of a concubine, raised by a nun, and on a mission to terminate the command of a provincial military governor. So far, so straightforward. And yet, the governor is her cousin, and the pair may be in love, and the assignment turns hazy, lost in the fog, and the fields of gorse. Henry, this is one of the best reviewed films of the last 12 months or so. It was Sight and Sound's film of the year, so very high claims about it. Did it win you over like it did others?
Oof. If The Big Short is a film that makes you occasionally feel smart without warranting it, this is a film that made me feel stupid and a philistine, because I've seen so many people call this film beautiful and riveting and immersive. All of those words to me equal boring. I have to say, I was just bored out of my mind and mystified as to what was going on with the plot. I'm so glad that you gave us the blurb, because you've basically explained what I've just spent the last 2.5 hours watching. I love this kind of thing normally. I love the stealthiness of the assassin, the way that the wind blows through the trees. And then there's a beautiful black and white opening scene where she murders a local dignitary. And it's just done with such grace. I mean, both in terms of the way it's filmed and the way she acts.
Yeah.
And you think, God, this is great. Just give me a riveting plot to go with this. And it never shows up. And so much beautiful cinematography, so many great stately moments, and so much confusion for me about what's going on and why I'm watching.
Peter, were you lost in the mist as well?
I very much sympathise with what he's saying. I mean, in a very earnest sort of mock A-level way, I did a lot of homework before I sat down to watch it. I've watched it twice. Even now, I can't claim to have grasped all of it. I think I grasped a lot more of it. Is it fair to expect audiences to do homework before they sit down to a film?
It's not.
Probably not. But there's no doubt about it. It's a very beautiful and mysterious and captivating film, and I'm so glad I saw it. I genuinely was glad to have watched it again. I think I could watch it a third time with, and I'm being as honest as I can, genuine pleasure. I genuinely did love it in a way, but I know what you meant.
Beauty is a story as well. Beauty is a narrative, and there is something immersive about it. And he's not going for the traditional kung fu high-concept plot.
There is a debate, I think, to be had, which first surfaced when Ang Lee made his very much more commercial Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was another wuxia film, and people were saying, well, wuxia is a tradition which is populist entertainment. It's supposed to be fast and funny, and people can know what's going on and all those other vulgar things. And I remember somebody told me at the time that for a true wuxia fan, to sit down to a movie like this, it's like sitting down to going to the cinema and thinking you're going to watch Hitchcock's Psycho and to find there's been a terrible mistake and they put on Douglas Gordon's 24-hour Psycho instead.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like that. There is a worry that this kind of movie is a kind of orientalist, glacial version of something which is already very well understood by its genuine fan base.
Yeah.
But that's how art happens.
It breaks the mold and it gives you an abstract.
It's transformative, it does something else. And I'm being as honest as I can when I say that it really is remarkable filmmaking, but without, I can't go the extra mile in a way that the connoisseurs that I've been reading have.
夏天之恩, enchanting for some, exasperating for others. That's Hu Xiaoxian's The Assassin. High time we return to the real world and the no-frills roughage of the documentary genre. This is Attacking the Devil.
What kind of adolescence will a 10-year-old boy look forward to when he has no arms, no legs, and is only 2 feet tall? That is the height of two whiskey bottles placed one on top of the other. How can an 11-year-old girl look forward to laughing and loving when she has no hand to be held and no legs to dance on?
Hatched in the laboratories of Nazi Germany, thalidomide was responsible for thousands of birth defects in the early 1960s. Here was a pharmaceutical scandal dismissed as an act of God, covered up by gagging writs and corporate lawyers. And it fell to Sunday Times editor Harold Evans to take on the courts and give a voice to the victims.
And the lawyer said, I think that's contempt. Our own lawyer. I said, well, so be it.
Peter, at the risk of log rolling, it's a film to restore your faith in journalism.
It really is. It's something I thought I knew vaguely about, but of course, I didn't know the half of it. I certainly had no idea about its origins among the industrial chemists of Germany of the 1940s. I had no idea about any of that. I also have to say, I had no idea about the amazingly dishonourable role played by the Minister of Health, Mr. Enoch Powell.
Always the ones you least suspect.
Always the one, I mean, yes, you thought you didn't like him already. This extraordinarily highly strung diva of a man who, through sheer peevish petulance and through resentment at the impertinence of popular campaigners who presumed to put the minister under pressure, just sided with the overdogs and blocked any official inquiry and certainly any official compensation. What an inglorious moment among many for Mr. Powell.
Mr. Powell wrote, no, sir. Okay, week after week, no, sir, no, sir, no, sir, no, sir.
I think it's an excellent documentary. I would say one thing that it could have analysed more, and that's the psychological taboo factor is that we forget now, at the time, for most people, the images of those children, and Harold Evans talks about it, how he thought that these pictures that he published were going to get an extraordinary reaction. He realized, no, publishing the pictures of the kids isn't the way to go, because people found those images simply too upsetting to look at and too upsetting to talk about. And the Distillers Group were able to exploit that taboo, because basically nobody wanted to talk about it, and they used the taboo in their favor. And I think maybe the film could have talked about that a little bit more. But otherwise, no, I thought it was a terrific film. A really terrific film, and it told me an awful lot.
It must have been a massive struggle for them, really. You know, they had the burden of taking on the court cases and everything, and I just got on with my childhood.
Henry, what did you reckon?
Yeah, amazing story, astonishing story, astonishing bravery, and by extension, a great film, I think. I think they really efficiently tell it. And
it's a very basic film. It's not.
It's a very basic
it's
film.
It's pretty down the line, isn't
but
it?
But, I mean, it bears comparison to Spotlight in that way. Mm-hmm. And the story itself is relatively simplistic. It's about determination and about the refusal to give in when the whole community around you is basically saying, just leave this, and, you know, it's not that important an issue. And what Harold Evans and the Sunday Times did was just keep at it like a dog with a bone, basically. And it's strange now seeing stories about hero journalists and bravery in journalism, because that surely is journalism's function, right, is to uncover these things. But increasingly in the world we're working in with straightened economic times and the online journalism, the speed at which working, it's got to be filed by five. You know, it is brave and it is heroic for newspapers to put this much resources into a story. A great film, an amazing story, and a brave guy.
As a professional journalist, one of the most piquant moments is when they have a rag out of the old Sunday Times and they have Harold Evans's byline, and then it's juxtaposed with Frank Giles's byline, the poor unfortunate who had to take over as Sunday Times editor when Harold Evans quit. Yeah. And what scoop did the Sunday Times come up with next? The Hitler Diaries. Oh, my God. You know, Harold Evans has given you a genuine scoop about Hitler and thalidomide, and now look what we've got. I mean, that's a horrible moment.
That's a horrible sequel in the
offing. It is a horrible sequel in the offing,
So we've now lost in the House of Lords. So what do we do? So we appealed to the European Commission of Rights. So we then got him bumpy airplane rides to Strasbourg week after week after week to argue the case before the court. And we won by two votes.
Mr. Evans, just how significant do you think this judgment is today?
Tremendous. It's the most important judgment for the, not only for the freedom of the press, but for the citizens' right to know in England. The most distinguished group of judges have told the British government, reform the laws. They've got to do it now.
The journalist as hero in Attacking the Devil. And continuing our theme of putting the most reviled professions centre stage, we now alight on Our Brand is Crisis, in which Billy Bob Thornton and Sandra Bullock play political spin doctors. And here they are weaving webs and talking dark arts with Nigel M. Smith.
She is the brightest and most innovative.
She's the best campaign strategist in the game.
Responsible for the greatest political upset in history.
You're a fighter, Jane. I'm giving you another shot at the title.
It's a presidential campaign in South America.
Fragile democracy,
economy in real trouble.
Our candidate is considered arrogant and out of touch with people's lives.
How far are you behind?
28 points.
These people can come in all because of a paycheck and the desire to win and use people like puppets and go home and punch the clock out. I'm fascinated by people like this because you get so angry and you're like, do they not feel anything? Mm-hmm. Do you not have any remorse? Do you not go home and drink yourself to death because you're just like, you're riddled with guilt? No, they don't, most of them. What are the people and who are the people who cave and who can't, that have to get off the carousel, as we say at the end, you know? So it's just that storytelling I love because it exists everywhere. Every big business, it's everywhere. It's in the media, it's everywhere. It's all around us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just politics.
Jane Bodine.
Pat.
So what are you doing here? I thought you retired or gave up or something.
What happened to your hair?
So you still got a great sense of humor.
How many times have you gone against Candy?
3 or 4 times.
How many times has he beat you?
3 or 4 times.
We're aware of all the political consultants and all. I mean, they're almost as popular as the politicians are. So there was a time when they truly were behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Still manipulating, doing what they're doing now, but they weren't part of of the conversation. Public conversation, right, yeah. Exactly. Now, because everything is popular, I mean, literally everything mm-hmm. is. It's like, oh, you have 10 shows about baking cakes. I don't remember one show about baking cakes when I was a kid. And so now we know all about how you make, donuts. We know how, there are shows about families who repair carburetors, and there's a whole show on the History Channel.
I like how that person, being constantly electrocuted.
Right. So you're flipping through and you're going, hey, I'm going to watch Arts and Entertainment, History Channel, and there's no history on there. It's all about...
What's there? You just got to get through Cake Wars and Cupcake Wars.
And all that kind of thing.
Cupcake Wars is good.
It's good. They're all good
show. Yeah. They got mad at me one time for saying something about them.
Oh, really?
Don't talk badly about cakes.
Henry, if nothing else, this gives us the latest incarnation of director David Gordon Green, who seems to have changed guises more than David Bowie, really, hasn't he?
He's all over the place, isn't he? What was the one before this? Manglehorn.
Joe. Before that, Joe was Your Highness and Pineapple Express. Yes. And then before that, George Washington and All the Real Girls.
Then Joe brought him back to sort of the Malekian mode. Yeah. And now he's kind of evolved away again.
I wonder if he wasn't pulled in as a bit of a gun for hire for this one, though. I mean, this is produced by George Clooney and Grant mm-hmm. Heslov and has the stamp of Clooney and Heslov all over it in terms of it being a pop political film that, again, makes you feel slightly smart, and then you come out of it thinking, actually, it was quite stupid.
Yeah. It's Warner Brothers, isn't it? So it smacks of favours being returned to Bullock and Clooney after Gravity.
Yeah, and Bullock is great in this. And when this premiered in Toronto, there was talk of her perhaps getting a Best Actress nomination at the Oscars.
She is good.
Which she hasn't pulled off, but she probably deserved one. But
it was a role that was originally written for Clooney.
It was originally written for a man,
because it's not your traditional Erin Brockovich female role.
Well, I mean, by the standards that were offered by modern Hollywood, right? So she doesn't talk about her family.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have a love interest. So
and she's not obviously sympathetic.
Yeah, those are the three incredibly low bars that she has to kind of hop over to be a progressive character in terms of a female actor. I mean, the film has pace, it zips along, it's got energy. Billy Bob Thornton and Sandra Bullock know what they're doing in this kind of role, playing off against each other. But it's based on a documentary which is based on real life events, and I didn't believe a second of it.
No.
I didn't understand why this supposedly hardened political analyst was surprised by any of the dodgy dealings going on or the dirty business. And then also there's the thing of Heslov and Clooney were at the press conference in Toronto and they were talking about the film and they were asked about the US presidential election and whether this kind of backroom dealing goes on in the US and what they think of that. And they didn't want to talk about their politics. They say it's all on the screen, which infuriates me when actors say that. It's like, why are you even involved with a political film if you don't want to talk about your own politics? And then somebody asked about Sandra Bullock's mooning scene, which is in this, and that became a story in itself. So that weirdly was, for me, a kind of metaphor for the film, is that it's more about Sandra Bullock's arse than it is about the very interesting political story that's going on behind the scenes. And it just lost its way and felt like it was going for entertainment over interest.
As with Wag the Dog, there is a supposed amount of satirical mileage in simply juxtaposing the super cool American sophisticates with the hilariously primitive foreigners. Either they're in Albania or Bolivia, but they are the absurd and hilarious people who aren't as clever as the Americans who've flown in. They have a kind of moral justification, of course, but they're simply not as clever.
It's the Argo
that's the
problem,
point,
right?
Yeah,
it's the same thing with Argo.
It's the same thing.
The Iranian people in that are just kind of a raving mob at the gate.
They're a mob, and the Bolivians are a mob, and they're exploited, and they're a lovely people, and all the rest of it. And so, I don't know, I felt I'd seen it so many times, and it's very shallow, this film. I mean, it's got a surface energy, and I would agree, yes, Bullock is all right. I don't think she's that great, to be honest with you, but she knows what she's doing. She does a professional job of work. Billy Bob Thornton, very still and deadpan. He's a very enigmatic character, Billy Bob Thornton.
I like
him as well, but what is he thinking about when he does those lines? Is he thinking about what he's having for supper tonight, or is he absolutely focused in the moment? I honestly don't know. But he does a professional job of work, and all their scenes work together perfectly well. But I felt this was disappointing. Considering what a blue-chip team it was, I don't know. I think it didn't really tell us anything we didn't know.
That's Our Brand is a Crisis, the final stop in a rogues gallery tour of hedge fund managers, killers, journalists, and spin doctors. Our moral compass has gone cockeyed.
our world turned upside down. And all that remains is to thank Peter and Henry. We're back, right side up, same time next week.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.